Welcome to the 70s Big Podcast. I'm Justin Lasik, the writer-editor of 70sbig.com, and also the host of this podcast. Winter is certainly coming, my friends. In the north, that is. In North Florida. It's 68 degrees in my apartment, and it's chilly. I had to put long sleeves on. This is not a tank top, friends. This is weird. In this podcast, we talk with Glenn Penley. We have a little interview with him about the Muscle Driver Grand Prix series, which is a series of weightlifting meets in 2012 that will offer at least $50,000 in prize money, which is pretty neat. We talk about the inaugural meet that is on November 5th in Charlotte. And then we get into some Q&A, question and answer. On the 70s Big Facebook fan page, I asked people to ask Glenn whatever they wanted, and we picked the best questions and a nice little session. Additionally, the Fit book is available on Amazon.com that came out a couple months ago. That's the book that I helped Dr. Lon Kilgore and Dr. Michael Hartman write, and it's a no-nonsense approach to general fitness, and I think it's definitely something that most trainees want to read, regardless if they are primarily strength training. The strength chapter is great. I think that's worth the price alone, but it definitely combines the elements of getting strong and then using high-intensity endurance training in order to get conditioned and fast and whatnot. So I think it's a great book, and it can help a lot of people. And you can find that on the 70s Big website, of course, but also if you search Fit in Amazon, then it's one of the first things that comes up. Also, the Texas Method Part 2 book, where I talk about how to use the Texas Method for powerlifting and advancing the template and some other variables that that are tweaked later in the later stage of the Texas Method, that is coming out in a couple weeks. I'm almost done writing it as of today, the day that this podcast comes out on October 20th. So just giving you guys a heads up on some other book and information type things that are coming out on the site. And without further ado, let's get to the interview with the big, jolly, joyous, wonderful Glenn Penley. And now we're here with Glenn Penley. Welcome back to the 70s Big Podcast, Glenn.
Thanks, Justin.
You and I have been talking about the Muscle Driver Grand Prix. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that series is and then what's coming up on November 5th in Charlotte?
Well, in Charlotte on November 5th is really a kind of a test event. It's a first run through for what should be the entire series next year. And what we have in mind for that is three preliminary events in different parts of the country. And I think that probably looking at one in California, one in either Texas or somewhere else in the Midwest, and then a third one in South Carolina. And the top finishers getting invited to a final, which will likely be held in the Orlando area. And the final is going to be, you know, the top 10 Sinclair finishes for both men and women. And it's an event that is really, I guess you'd say, it's custom made for the media. I mean, we're really, really trying to get media exposure and possibly even TV. I think we have a very real chance of getting on something like ESPN, mostly because we're doing the format specifically to make it friendly for TV. And the nice thing is, you know, we're looking at putting up some very good prize money. We've talked about, you know, for the three preliminary events and then the final, a total of around $50,000 in prize money, with about half that being given away at the final. So we have some very ambitious ideas, that's for sure. This one that's going to take place on November 5th this year is a run through, I guess, to see how the community reacts to it and see if it's something that people want to do, that people are going to participate in. And it should be a hell of a fun event. Yeah. Absolutely, no doubt.
I'd say that,
There is $10,000 in prize money for the one on November 5th. So it's not.
And that ranges from
some substantial money there, I think.
That ranges from $400 to $2,000 for between.
Yeah, the first place male and the first place female win $2,000 each, and then that goes down. Gosh, I should have this off the top of my head, but I don't. But I think it's something like 1,200 for second, 800 for third, and on down to fifth place.
It's 600 for fourth place, and then $400
for
fifth place.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool because, you know, for a couple of reasons. Number one, I don't know. My involvement in the sport of weightlifting hasn't been that long, but I don't know of any meets in the time that I've been involved that actually reward with money when you do well in the meet, right?
Well, you know, you have the Arnold. The Arnold is a great event. It's a fantastic event. One of the big differences between this event and the Arnold is, number one, we're giving away a lot more money, and number two, it's American lifters only, and it is wonderful to be able to go to the Arnold and see some of the better international lifters.
Definitely.
That we've all only seen on video. You know, one year they had Klockow's been there a couple years. One year they had two of the Chinese Olympic gold medalists. There's been others. It's wonderful to see those guys lift, but what happens is when you have, you know, $3,000 or $5,000 worth of prize money, and you know, one or two foreign lifters come in and take most of it, you're not really seeing a lot of Americans win. And again, it's not a criticism of the Arnold. I think it's wonderful to invite and get those lifters over here. But one of the things we wanted to do different is actually put the money into American weightlifting and make the incentive for the U.S. lifters to push themselves a little bit and go a little harder to try to get some of that money. And when you start talking about, you know, you talk about $2,000 or $3,000 is one thing, but you know, again, assuming this event is well received, well accepted by the weightlifting community, and we go on with the whole series next year, you start talking about $50,000 or more. That's something people I think is going to make a difference for some people.
Yeah, and I think that it's I think it's very cool. And also to point out why the format would be good for TV, it's that it's based on the Sinclair, because obviously most weightlifting meets, just talking to the other listeners that may not be that may not have competed in weightlifting, it's usually, you know, first, second, third in each individual weight class. So by ranking everyone based on their Sinclair, which is a formula that Glenn can elaborate on if he wants to, but it'll you know, place everyone kind of in a big group together and make it very viable for a TV presentation, as opposed to having, you know, 6, 7, 8, up to 10 different sessions with different weight classes and stuff, kind of like internationals are. So it'll kind of streamline it and just involve everybody in one competitive event. And also, from a strategy perspective, force coaches and lifters to choose their attempts based on how it'll affect their Sinclair, as opposed to just their just absolute total. So I think that's interesting too.
Yeah, what it does is it magnifies the drama, basically. And, you know, at Nationals, every single weight class competes against each other, and you only got one or two guys that really have any chance of winning, usually. We're really not that deep. And so, you know, there's just, you go out of 10 hours a day for 3 days to get just a few moments here and there that are actually dramatic moments when, you know, you lift a weight and you win, and you don't, you lose. But you make it by Sinclair in the top 10 overall, and all of a sudden every single lift has ramifications, and almost every single lift involves, you know, has importance as far as whether you walk away with $5,000 or $10,000 or whatever. So that's the kind of thing that gets the media, is, you know, they want a lot of drama and have it condensed down to where they can actually, you know, get it out there to spectators. And it's going to be an exciting meet, even above and beyond the media considerations. It's going to be a hell of a format. It's going to be a very, very exciting meet to see, you know, your great lighter lifters like Chad Vaughn competing against the heavier guys like Shankle and Mendez, and everybody equalized for body weight by the Sinclair formula, and seeing who comes out on top. I can't think of a more exciting thing to watch, actually, if you're into watching weightlifting, at least.
Yeah, I think it's cool because especially locally, you don't really see many matchups like that. And if you watch some old battles, Pizarenko versus Krostev, as they were going back and forth, and then I guess we could even go back to Alexiev and the clean and press meet. What was that?
Serge Redding.
Yes, Serge Redding and Alexiev, and then even Dimas and Mark, the German, what's his name?
Myself.
Oh, he jumps every time he hits a...
It starts with an H.
Huster? Huster?
Huster, yeah, or Huster.
So they've had some great battles in the 85, and I just remember reading Iron Mind a lot, and just reading about back-and-forth battles when people clash against each other, maybe three, four guys that are vying for a spot in total or in snatch or in clean jerk, and that really hasn't happened a lot in American weightlifting, like you said. So I think it'll be cool to.
No, we're not deep. If you think about some of the guys that people consider the greatest weightlifters of all time that have the biggest fan base, Demas and Huster really have. It's kind of funny, but Demas. There's several guys in that weight class or the old 82.5 weight class that have lifted more than Demas. He's never, done what, say, Vardanian or somebody did. But the thing that makes him really, I think the thing that's made him such a star and such a huge fan base is, he always had those really tight contests. I think his first Olympic gold medal, gold, silver, and bronze all tied, and the medals were awarded on body weight.
Oh, wow.
So he's, unlike, some of the greats of the past who are great lifters, I mean, certainly lifted huge weights and are wonderful lifters, but Demas has kind of stood out because he's won so many times in such close competition, and not ever really just walked away from everyone and lifted 20 kilos more. He's managed to win, three Olympic gold medals where, he was down to his last lift, and incredibly close competition each time. And it's a lot more exciting when that happens than to watch, somebody win by 50 kilos.
And another important point to make about this inaugural meet in November 5th is that you're going to get on a C2 rower and challenge Brad Hess to a Concept 2 rowing competition. What's this all about?
Well, it started with a lot of kind of crap talking on the internet and on Facebook.
Which is
I
only natural.
I opened my big mouth, and now I have to kind of put up or shut up. Brad and Caleb Ward had a rowing contest. Caleb Ward, if you don't know him, he holds the American junior American record in the clean and jerk at 446 pounds or 203 kilos. But he works for Muscle Driver, and Brad is the president of Muscle Driver, and they had a rowing contest, and Caleb did 130 and Brad did 133 for a 500 meter row. And as they were, kind of bantering back and forth about it, I had to open my big mouth and say that I had rowed a 129 a few years ago. And so that became a point of contention, whether, as they called it, my phantom 129 that no one had ever witnessed. It became a point of contention, so I offered to row with them when I came down for the Grand Prix, and the challenge was accepted. And now, if I do not row 129, I'm going to be basically humiliated for life. So I have been doing a little bit of training for that, and I'm very, very much hoping that Brad comes in overconfident and underprepared, and I could actually have a shot at winning. So.
Well,
it's been quite the change for me to be training, more on the endurance, side than actual strength training. But
right.
It's been fun. It's been fun.
Speaking of which, another type of rowing, people always refer to the Penlay rows online. And my friend Jacob referenced that you walked over and rowed 140 kilos in front of John North show him?
I haven't done any real strength training or certainly not rowing for 5 or 6 years, but John and Kevin Cornell were you know how things get said in the gym. they were of the opinion that at my old, out of shape, overweight, condition that I was not currently still stronger than they were. So they happened to have 140 kilos in the bar from doing some power cleans, and I had to row it a few times to then challenge him to repeat the feat, and they couldn't, so that gave me gym bragging rights for a few days at least.
Awesome. Well, of course we brought you on here to talk about the Muscle Driver stuff, but now let's get to some question and answer stuff. You cool with that?
Hey, there's one more thing I want to mention about the Muscle Driver
meet
that we didn't really go over, but I have heard several people that have been talking about this meet and saying, oh, this is going to be such a big meet. I don't want to enter. I don't have any chance.
Right.
And all that. And I wanted to point one thing out that I don't think a lot of people are looking at, and that is the date of the competition, November 5th, means that the folks on the world team are going to be in Paris when this meet takes place, and they're not going to be there. And a lot front of the folks that, you know, are thinking that I don't have a shot at winning are going to be the ones that probably walk away with the money.
That's right.
Because this meet's going to take place without the absolute top-tier lifters, without the folks up in the top 10. And, you know, it's going to, and to be honest, you know, the American Open, which is going to figure predominantly in Olympic team rankings and a place at the Olympic trials, is like 3 weeks after this meet. So a lot of the folks, even that didn't make the world team, that are looking at their spot in the Olympic trials and things, again, are not going to be there. So a lot of the folks that are saying, oh, I don't have a chance, it's not going to be guys like Kendrick Ferris and Donnie Schenkel that walk away with the money. It's going to be somebody you don't expect and probably maybe even don't know, who don't recognize their name. And so the, you know, people, but you gotta enter to win, obviously. And the whole idea that, you know, you wouldn't want to enter if you don't think you're going to walk away with a couple of grand in cash is, I think, erroneous too, because this is going to be a hell of an event. We're really trying to create a series of events that are going to get weightlifting to the masses by creating some media coverage and just being fun events. I mean, we're gonna all eat barbecue and you get to watch me throw up after I probably get my butt kicked on the C2 rower. And it's gonna be a fun event. There's gonna be a lot of good coaches there. One of the things that I'm really going to make sure happens is we're going to have a lot of experienced coaches that are available to help beginners and to spend some time with some of the folks. I know there's a lot of lifters out there that are lifting without coaching and doing things on their own, and this is going to be a wonderful meet for somebody's first meet experience.
Yeah, I think that's awesome, because I said this on the post I did about this on October 18th, but my first meet was in a barn in Texas, and it was, you know, a spoon barbell place, but I had a lot of fun, but it would have been really neat to have a nice warm-up facility and nice platforms to lift on and just getting a lot of, especially if you're an uncoached weightlifter, to actually get a lot of experience from coaches and everything that are willing to help out, and they don't have the stress of a national meet or trying to get their lifters to really
put up gold medals. My biggest personal goal for this meet is to make it the best first or second competition that anybody could possibly have.
Yeah.
You know, the money's going to take care of itself. Yeah, there's going to be some people win money, and that's wonderful, and I think that, you know, I think that's great. But I want this meet to be the absolute best meet that a person could pick for their very first weightlifting meet or for their second or third. I really am trying to make it my mission, and every single beginner that chooses to enter this meet is going to walk away a better lifter.
Yeah, and so the point is, it's not a meet that a beginner should shy away, because it's aimed at the beginner, and this is the place that a beginner would want to go in order to do their first meet, especially when they don't have a coach. So, and I'm sure there'll be people willing to handle them in the weightlifting. And then, I mean, shit, when I went to Nationals, Paul Doherty offered to handle me in the warm-up room just because I didn't have anybody to handle me. So, I mean, it already happens at national meets, but now there's people actually committed to saying, hey, look, we will help you if you need it, because that's what we're here to do. This is supposed to be fun.
Yeah,
I think it's going to be, I think it'll be a cool meet.
We're trying to promote the sport. We're trying to grow the sport. We're trying to get more people into the sport, and we're trying to reward the top guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying to do all of that. And like I said, that's my the money's going to take care of itself. But me personally, I'm really committed to making this the greatest competition that can be for the beginner.
Yeah.
That's one of the big focuses.
And just observing the, you know, the internet bantering of people putting down USAW, blah, 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 and needing to expand and grow the sport of weightlifting, this is the time for people to kind of like put up and shut up, because this is an event that will do that. And enough bitching on the internet and just finally going and, you know, participating in a unique event.
Yeah, if you've griped about there being no money in weightlifting and no rewards to the top performers, if you've griped about nobody doing anything to get media coverage, if you've griped about any of those things, then throw down your money and come to the Grand Prix, because we're doing something about it.
Yeah, I think it'll be a fun meet, and it'll be real cool to see how it turns out. You ready to do some question and answer?
There you go. Let's get to it.
Alrighty. I'll get to some of the. I won't do them in order, but these, of course, are all real submitted questions from the fan page. So that means that they're not always on task, but that's how it is with 70s Big. Let's go with the first one that's kind of on task, and I think it's a real good question. Craig K asks, how does the push press carry over to the jerk, and you know, what's the utility in that? So what are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, the push press, in my opinion, carries over to everything. I think it's reasonably well known that I'm a big fan of the push press. I think it's a great upper body exercise. Maybe it just, if you're strong on push press, you're strong at anything. As far as the jerk, you know, the push press is one of the lifts that I use as a in the teaching progression for the jerk. It's in the USA Weightlifting Manuals. It is one of the lifts for the teaching progression of the jerk. It teaches you how to dip and drive straight and correct without having to worry about, you know, catching the bar, splitting your feet. As far as strength, when you need the strength in the jerk is at the top, because your legs push the bar up, your arms push your body down. But you've also got to be strong enough to lock it at the top and hold it. And the push press, because you're using your legs to drive the bar fairly high, and the arms kind of take over at the top, it's a lot more specific to the jerk. You're building that strength at the top with a heavier weight, which a jerk is obviously a heavier weight than the press. But because of that, the strength built in the push press is a little more specific to the jerk than, say, a regular press. But you have to be careful, though. You know, there's a lot of lifters, Klockoff, for instance, doing an unbelievable 225 push press. You got another guy that was up recently with a 235 push press. That's just insane. I mean, that is absolutely insane. I you know, just for comparison, you know, there was a video somewhere that I saw that had Mariusz Puzynowski, who is the world's strongest man for how many years? I have, you know, 4 or 5 years.
Right.
Doing, struggling and barely getting a 182 push press. So here's the guy that's the world's strongest man, you know, has that title, and he's push pressing 182 kilos. And here's these guys doing 225, 235. It's nuts. It's crazy. But you know, the Russians a long time ago, I was actually just talking to Bud Charnock about this within the last 2 weeks, actually found that at the lower levels of lifting, the push press correlated well with the jerk, but at the upper levels, the elite levels, the push press and the jerk were actually negatively correlated, meaning the guys that were the worst push pressers were the best jerkers. And I think that's a good lesson that if you're just worried about the jerk, if you're an Olympic weightlifter, any assistance exercise can be taken too far.
Sure.
And the way I would explain it, in a way that you know, I think several other coaches would explain it, is, you know, the movement pattern is obviously different than a jerk. And in a push press, you push with your arms, you know, the whole way, and you're not moving under it. And in a jerk, pushing bar up with the arms causes you to go out of position, lean backwards, and often miss the jerk. And so, you know, you can go overboard with it. There's absolutely no doubt. And, you know, the fact that it doesn't correlate, doesn't correlate perfectly at the higher levels of the sport, I think is a good thing to understand when you're trying to get your jerk up. I mean, yeah, if you need more strength, if you need to develop the dip and drive, you need more lockout strength, which all beginner lifters do, certainly great exercise. On the other hand, at some point, continuing to push your push press up is not going to mean that your jerk follows it.
Right. Would you agree with the idea that in the early part of someone's development in weightlifting, and development would imply strength, muscularity, yeah, balance in the strength, that the, you know, strength training, like in the example of push press or any other type of weight movement, is more frequently used, and then as someone develops in the lifts and they get to be, they start advancing, that they'll start stripping away that strength stuff because it's more of assistance, and they'll get more into an approach that you know, your lifters have, which is snatch, clean and jerk, squat, and then messing around with some assistance to boost their lifts or to help them recover. Would you kind of like agree with that kind of like shift in training philosophy, that early on there's more strength training, and that kind of like you kind of whittle that away as someone gets more focused into weightlifting itself?
I mean, most of the beginner programs I write, if it's for, especially if it's for a younger kid, have bench pressing once a week and push pressing once a week. And obviously, guys like Donnie Shankle or John North don't bench press once a week anymore.
Right.
So, and in general, I agree with that. I would say though that in the first few weeks, maybe even month, I generally spend most of the time learning to snatch and learning to clean and jerk.
Okay.
I mean, right at the very start, the top priority is learn to do the movements, learn to do them correctly, and then we kind of go into a more balanced program.
Assuming competency in the lifts, would that then be more of the case? Kind of depending on the lift.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, and it would be, but you gotta think about who you're talking about. If you're talking about a 12-year-old kid that shows up and he's a stick, and he weighs 110 pounds and he's
right.
5'6" or something. Yeah, definitely. We are going to do some general training. Absolutely. We're going to be bench pressing. We're going to be push pressing. We're going to be squatting. We're going to be doing RDLs or some form of pulling that's heavier than a clean pull. We're probably going to be doing some conditioning stuff, like some kettlebells and stuff like that. Some, prehab stuff with the shoulders. I mean, it's a more rounded program.
Right.
Yeah. By the time you have gotten to a certain stage, there's going to be a higher percentage of time spent on snatching and clean and jerking. One thing that's a corollary of that sort of is a beginner, if it's very often that you will see somebody come in, and let's just use some stupid numbers, but some numbers just for comparison. Some kid comes in and he can squat 200 pounds and he can clean and jerk after a couple of weeks with fairly decent technique. The bar's moving in the right direction at least. He can clean and jerk 100 pounds. So he's clean and jerking 50% of his squat.
Right.
Is the clean and jerk at that time really a big driver of strength gains? Not so much, because he's only able, because of his limited coordination with the lift and limited mastery of the lift, he's only able to clean and jerk, 50% of his back squat. On the other hand, let's say the kid now is back squatting 200 pounds and he's clean and jerking 165 pounds. Now, is the clean and jerk a big driver of strength gains? Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely it is. So, when someone is at the elite level, the snatch and clean and jerk are very big, basic strength exercises because they are good enough at them that they're using very significant weights that are normally a pretty dang high percentage of what they could, say, squat, deadlift, et cetera, et cetera. But beginners don't. Beginners aren't in that situation. And so beginners need more general exercises because they're not good enough at the lifts for the lifts to be big strength drivers.
What about a
kid?
Yeah. What about a guy that's maybe in his early 20s, is not necessarily weak and stick like? Maybe, let's say, I don't know, about 180 pounds, has okay strength, but he's not strong as far as like what we would consider strong in a strength training online community. Maybe he squats 300. Is this going to be a guy, and let's say he has acceptable technique. Of course, everyone can improve their technique most of the time. But would you kind of have an approach that would combine snatch and clean and jerk with some basic strength stuff, or would you?
Definitely. I have a beginner's program that's on the Pendlay.com website that's a generic beginner's Olympic weightlifting program,
right.
And it's about half exercises that are either snatch, clean, and jerk, or pretty specific to the snatch, clean, and jerk, and about the other 50% of it is strength exercises, and it ranges from push presses and squats and a couple of different kinds of pulls and, just various stuff. And then one thing that we do with beginners is we do at Cal Strength, we're very big on doing some kind of complexes after the workout. And for each person, it can be a little bit different. Those include, shoulder prehab type stuff, core stuff, basic exercises like rowing and dumbbell rows, barbell rows, just general stuff. It can be kettlebell stuff, just general stuff to make you overall strong, injury proof, condition, whatever. That's about the percentage I would think with your average starting place,
right.
Your guy that's not squatting 500 pounds, or whatnot, just just average overall development while you learn the lifts.
Regarding those complexes, are those more so for a way to combine some stuff in a row to get some ancillary work on some musculature, like you said, prehab, and you're talking about that as opposed to more of a conditioning effect, is that correct?
It's both, and what it is a convenient way to kind of individualize and give people what they need. You know,
yeah.
You do this workout, then you have two complexes to do after. We're going to pick the complex for one. It may be three different shoulder prehab exercises. Another may be, you know, reverse hypers followed by, you know, jackknife sit-ups, and do three or four sets of each, you know, back to back, you know, going from one to the other. Another, it might be something involving, you know, a rowing or a pressing exercise or a kettlebell snatch or this or that. It's a time saver. It's not the most important thing we're doing in the workout.
Sure.
It's not enough to totally program differently, but you look at a kid and you're like, you know, after the workout, this is what complexes you're doing today. And it's pretty easy to just, you know, go by look and by feel on who needs to do what. It's a convenient way to program all the extra stuff that you want to do after you get done snatching, clean, and jerking, and squatting.
Right, basically. Just to sprinkle it in and get it done in an efficient amount of time, right?
Well, yeah, that's the other big thing. You put some things in a complex. Is it ideal from a strength training standpoint? No, it's probably not. On the other hand, it takes them 5 minutes to get it done. They've already been in the gym an hour and 20 minutes, and they want to, you know, either they want to get out of there, or their mom wants them to hurry up,
yeah,
so she can take them home and fix them supper. You know?
Of course.
If you do everything, you know, you can't do everything, first off. But a lot of times you keep putting one more thing in a program because, hey, it'd be better if I did this, it'd be better if I did this. Pretty soon, you're in the gym for 2.5 hours and, you know, you just can't have that
with most
beginners. So,
going off on the second part of Craig's question, you obviously like to use push press a lot. Do you see similar or related utility in just the, I guess we could consider the military press or just the standing press compared to the push press?
Not as much for weightlifting, no. And I would rather use the push press in weightlifting than the military press any day, because if you're a beginner, you're going to be, unless your shoulders are inflexible, you're going to be doing a little bit of bench pressing also.
Right.
And so you're developing that basic, you know, that basic upper body strength already. And between the push press and the military press, the push press is just so much more specific to the jerk than the military press. In my opinion, that makes it the better lift for an Olympic lifter.
Use more weight as well as compared to a
strength press. I've always said the push press, I think the push press carry, you show me someone that can push press, you know, 400 pounds, that guy is going to be strong on the bench press, he's going to be strong on the dumbbell press, he's going to be strong on the military press. You'll be strong on everything, even without doing it. This strength gained from the push press seems to me it carries over well. Carries over very well to almost anything else you do upper body. Whereas, you know, I certainly, we all know guys, and I have been a guy that could bench press pretty decent, but couldn't military press or do anything overhead worth a crap, you know? I like the push press because it just carries over. It makes you strong on everything if you get strong on the push press. And a lot of that's probably because of the, you know, really overloading the top. You know, if you can military press 200 and you can push press 250, you know, you're getting a lot of extra, you know, stimulation to the triceps at the top, I guess.
Right. So second question, or second person asking the question, is the infamous AC. He wants to know if you eat Oreos.
Only if they're fried.
I've never had a fried Oreo.
No, actually, I have had a fried Oreo, but I don't eat a lot of junk food. You couldn't tell it by how fat I am, but honestly, I just don't buy the stuff. It's been a long time since like a bag of potato chips or a candy bar has been inside my house. I just don't buy it.
Yeah.
Because I don't have the willpower to not eat it if it's actually sitting in my kitchen. I'm the guy that if I open a bag of potato chips, I'm probably going to finish it in one sitting. So I just a long time ago stopped buying that stuff and I just don't buy it, and I haven't for a long time. If I overeat, which I you know, do frequently. It's going to be steak and, you know, homemade food that, right. that I make at home.
In your defense, I've heard you described as bear-like as opposed to fat. So that's a good trait to have.
Let's put it this way. I'm fatter than when I was a competitive lifter, and to me, that's fat. So, you
know. Okay.
I don't know.
All right, moving on to the next question. Chris W. asks, when would one benefit from block pulls? He kind of goes off on some various questions. I'll get through them all. When should they stick to pulling from the floor? How often would you do the block pulls? How often do you do reps below the knees? So kind of the just area of training, including pulling from the knees and stuff.
Well, I think that in an ideal world, you know, you would just snatch the bar every time from the floor. However, we don't live in an ideal world. And one thing that pulling off various heights of the block gives us is the ability to get a lot more reps in without the same stress level on the body of the lifter. Bringing that bar from the floor to the knees is more difficult to recover from, in my and many other people's opinion, than the other parts of the lift. And by taking that out of it, it allows you to get a lot more work done, especially if the top of the pull or the catch or some other part is what you actually have to, is where your actual weakness is on the lift. As far as from a technical standpoint, putting the bar below the knee is a great way to really emphasize pushing with the legs for the start. And that's an important concept in weightlifting. Is to start the bar by pushing with the thighs and not by opening up the back angle. It's very right. difficult to do when the bar is right below your knees on a block, but if you can do it then, it's very easy to do off the floor. And that's one of the reasons that I love the block below the knee. Now, when people put the block to where the bar is, they raise the block up to where the bar is mid-thigh or even upper thigh, you're just purely working on your top pull. And that can be useful for some lifters if they don't have a good explosion on the second pull. It's not something I use a ton, but we do use the below the knee position a lot for both the technical aspect of it. The other aspect, there's a reason that we pull from right below the knee, not necessarily off blocks all the time, but we often do, you know, like a snatch from the floor and followed without putting the bar down by a snatch below the knee. We work that position because that should be, I guess you'd say biomechanically, the weakest position that you go through if you're lifting correctly, because your shoulders are out over the bar
right.
More at that position than any other, and it's a tremendous stress on your hamstrings, you know, posterior chain, whatnot. And lifting and trying to accelerate the bar from that position is difficult. And it's a wonderful, you know, builder of strength in that specific position that you need to be strong in. We also do far out from a meet. We don't do these close to a competition because they just kick the hell out of you. But we do a lot of lifts from the floor. We'll take a 2-second pause right below the knee. And that's hard. If you actually stop the bar, a lot of people do it, and what they don't realize is the bar keeps, you know, slowly moving up or down. But if you actually stop the bar and hold it motionless for 2 seconds, then complete the pull, that is hard, and that is very good at developing strength in that position. And it's also very good for correction. I use that a fair amount with people who are pretty much beginners, not necessarily from the strength building standpoint, but that's the position that most people screw up. It's easy to put someone in the right start position because they're stopped. I mean, they're just sitting there.
Right.
And you can rearrange them into the correct position. But most people from the start to the knee somehow screw it up when they're beginners, and having them stop at the knee and actually being able to go and correct them and push the knees back and, you know, push the shoulders out a little more and say, okay, now finish the lift, is wonderful for correcting, you know, wonderful for correcting technique. So we use below the knee a variety of ways, and I think it's pretty valuable for a lot of lifters.
What type of trainee would you, or lifter, would you say that this would be something they should try? It seems like it'd be more of a, I don't know, intermediate or slightly advanced thing, not something that beginners would need to worry about for a while. Would you agree with that, or where would you place it in?
Well, pausing below the knee for form correction at that stage of the lift, then finishing the lift is a beginner's move, you know. But everybody else, it's very individual. I mean, when it comes to the Olympic lifters, I have everybody snatch and clean and jerk, but even my guys that I coach now that are all on a pretty high level, they do different, I guess you call it assistance exercises after they snatch and jerk. Some of them might go for the knee, some of them do a high pull and then a snatch, and it's just based on what they need. But in general, if you see a lifter who is not wanting to stay out over the bar, is wanting to open the back angle too soon, it is not wanting to hold that over the bar position, that's a lifter who could do more work from below the knee, because you can fix that position, you can build strength in that position. I say a lot of times having bad technique is a result of not being strong enough in that position, because if you can't hold that position, if you're not strong enough to keep your shoulders out over the bar in that, you know, biomechanically weaker position, you're just right. not going to do it. And when you pull fast, you're going to change somehow. And a lot of times when you find someone that has bad technique and they're getting their shoulders behind the bar too early, and you make them stronger in that particular position, all of a sudden their technique improves because now they're strong enough to do it right.
Good.
I don't know if that answered your question.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it does.
What the original question was.
Yeah, I'm just kind of more so pointing out that a coach would be the one to have someone do the pauses, and then they wouldn't be involved in, because I know Chris W. who asked that question, and I wouldn't classify him as someone who would be in that realm of regularly needing the pulls in that position. However, I don't know enough about him because I haven't actually met him in person, but we've talked quite a bit, and he kind of helps out with some stuff, with some images every now and then. So I was just asking that to kind of get it more specific to him.
Honestly, most people who are dabbling in Olympic lifting, you know, and aren't like Olympic lifters, they Olympic lift, but they also do CrossFit or a little bit of powerlifting, or they're working their biceps, or, you know, whatever. Most people like that aren't going to be in a position of lifting weight enough that are lifting weights that are as close enough to their actual maximal strength to really need to build specific strength in a part of the lift. Usually it's a technical problem that keeps them from snatching 130 instead of 110. And that's the kind of person who probably a lot of times can use the block from the mid thigh or something, because you can do so much more work and so much more work on the correct timing and the correct catch than you can if you pull from the floor. And 9 times out of 10, a lifter like that, that's more of a recreational lifter, you know, they're snatching or clean and jerking rather low percentages of their squat, and it's usually a timing issue, you know, a position
sure.
or timing issue rather than a strength issue.
Right. You also, when you mentioned what other people might be training for, you forgot getting jacked and tan, because that's pretty big.
I thought that was a given.
Okay. I just want to clear that up. Seven Escalante, who I met at USAPL, the 2011 Raw Nationals, she asks, without steady access to a coach, what are the better resources for improving technique? Are they instructional DVDs, online coaching, books? What's the best way to improve technique when you don't have a coach?
Well, honestly, I'm going to start this off by saying what most people do wrong. Your typical person doesn't have, you know, that's a little unsure of themselves, is going to take a couple videos, and then they're going to post it on about 9 different forums. And
right.
most of which forums have, well, 3/4 or more, it depends on the forum, I guess, sometimes it'd be 9/10, of the people who respond know even less about weightlifting technique, or even less about what may or may not be wrong, than the person who posted the videos.
Yeah.
And they end up getting 150 responses over these 9 or 10 forums, and about 3 of them are from anyone that knows their butt from a hole in the ground, and nothing ends up happening. They you can't take advice from everybody, I guess. You just can't. And some people you just shouldn't take advice from in the first place. Instead of that, what I would do is try to find one person who, through, you know, demonstrable characteristics, knows something about weightlifting, whether they produced, you know, a fair amount of good athletes themselves, or whether they've snatched 150 kilos themselves, or for some reason you have reason to believe, other than the fact that, you know, they have a cool name on an internet forum, that they actually know something about the lifts, and see if you can privately email them, Facebook them, and say, would you mind taking a look at my lifts?
Right.
And develop some sort of a, you know, don't bug the poor guy to death, but develop some sort of a relationship where you may be able to shoot him a video every 2 or 3 weeks or something.
So, so what about...
I have a lot of people that I do that for. I never mind doing it. People, you know, when I'm on Facebook or something, some chat box shows up at the bottom. So they say, hey, will you look at this video real quick? Sure. It'll take me 15 seconds. It's no skin off my back. I'm happy to do it. But, you know, find some one person that you trust for a good reason, not just because, again, you know, they got a following on, you know, whatever bodybuilding forum, whatever, you know. But some reason, you know, and ask that person and go back to the same person, you know, again and again, because there's nothing like you ask one person one day, what do I do? And they say one thing, and you ask somebody else 3 days, and they tell you the opposite. You just run in circles and chase your tail, and it's horrendous, and it's just a bad deal.
Right. Now, what about, as opposed to just meeting a cool guy on the internet, what are actually maybe some products or actually, like, for example, you have some videos that teach some technique, and I've had a guy send me some videos, and I think you were in the chat room one night when a guy posted his videos, and I was like, this looks pretty good. How'd you learn it? And he was like, I just watched Penlay's videos. And I was like, okay, cool.
We have some really good stuff on the Penlay.com site. We have instructional videos on how to teach or how to learn the pull for the snatch and the pull for the clean. And I think we have a jerk one up too. And then there's, you know, a bunch of articles. There's some videos by Don McCauley, who's a great coach. And he's got some really good drills to try to assist in making the correct movements more natural. And we have, you know, articles out by a number of coaches, quite a few from me and some from Don and several other coaches that for some reason not on the tip of my tongue right now, but there's a lot of pretty decent info there certainly are. And those videos on how to learn to snatch and clean are exactly the way that I teach people how to do them in my seminars and stuff. It's a very simple method. And I've had several people walk in the gym and want to come train, and they actually doing a halfway decent snatch. I'm like, how'd you learn that? And they say the same thing. Well, I watched the video online, and, you know. So I think those videos work pretty well. There's other videos out there by other coaches and whatnot that work also. Everybody's got a slightly different method of getting there, but we all kind of want to arrive at the same point. And of course, we all think our way is the best.
Is there any
more than one way that works? But I think those videos on Penlay.com are pretty good, though.
Yeah. Is there any specific book or anything, or any other type of tangible resource that you think is really good?
I think that if you are only going to buy one book about Olympic weightlifting, if you're only going to buy one, the Weightlifting Encyclopedia by Artie Dreschler is the best book. Because it is exactly what it says. It's an encyclopedia. It's everything you ever wanted to know about weightlifting from A to Z. If you are mainly looking at technique and pull technique in particular, if you really want a book that about technique, Don McCauley's book Power Trip is very good. Greg Everett's book is a good book. It is more of a gentle book about this, you know, the sport overall, and it is probably easier to read and actually get through than Artie Dreschler's Weightlifting Encyclopedia. That is a very large, long, detailed book. Greg's a little more oriented, I think, towards the beginner. But those are three books that I would recommend.
Okay, excellent. Okay, Kyle S. asks, what do you recommend, either a place or a brand, of purchasing non-athletic type of shorts for bigger guys?
Well, I myself am kind of a clothes snob, and so I only go to Walmart for my shorts. Oh,
the clothes snob goes to Walmart. What the
Well,
hell?
Yeah, I just refuse to go to any lesser store. I buy cargo shorts that are the Faded Glory brand from Walmart, and I mean, I've had people, attempt to let me, get me to just go to the mall or something just because it's convenient. And, I just refuse. So, Walmart, you must, Faded Glory, cargo shorts.
California Walmart.
I work out in the damn things too. They're not, they're actually in both a casual short and an athletic short because they're what I train in.
Well, California Walmarts must be different because here in Florida and Panama City, I saw a guy wearing, I actually took a picture of him and I have it. He was wearing a children's Little League windbreaking jacket that was open. He wasn't wearing a shirt underneath. He had on a ponytail and a ball cap and wearing jeans and boots in the middle of June, which was about 105 degrees plus humidity and whatnot. So I see some characters in Walmart here, and so I try and...
Yeah. Well, I think you see characters in Walmart everywhere, but on the shorts front, I'm pretty sure that you can find the Faded Glory brand in pretty much all, even Florida, I'm pretty sure they're there. we actually don't have the big super Walmarts here in California. In Texas, they have the great big, really nice Walmarts. Here, the Walmarts are old, and they're small. I don't get it. I really don't. California is an upscale place, you'd think. San Francisco, I live near San Francisco. There's certainly, you can certainly spend a lot of money on just about anything here if you have half a mind to. Yet they don't have a big Walmart. I just don't understand why they'd stand.
It's because instead of
how they'd stand for such a thing here.
It's because instead of going to Walmart, like going to the zoo, you go to Trader Joe's or stores like that to see weird people.
Or just go to San Francisco.
That's true. Kyle also asks if you have any tips for integrating conditioning work into an intermediate strength training program.
I don't want to pass myself off as thinking I'm an expert on conditioning. I'm really not. But I will say this. When I have lifters, the young lifters, who are, maybe past the beginner stage in weightlifting, even becoming decent weightlifters, but they're still fat and out of shape, which is certainly possible to snatch fairly well and be totally out of shape, I think. I make them do kettlebells, and I make them do 5-minute nonstop or 10-minute nonstop sets. And I have found that interferes very, very little with their strength training.
Okay.
And it gets people in shape very quickly, and it actually increases the work capacity of what they can do in training. And I sort of think that maybe part of that increase in work capacity is because kettlebell snatches, kettlebell clean and jerks are similar to the actual movements, the Olympic lifting movements, and probably work the same muscles in much the same fashion, and seem to be something that don't interfere, increase work capacity, get people in shape.
So
a lot of stuff that we've tried before, like prowler pushing and stuff, we use that for the guys that are going to the NFL combine and stuff. And I think it's very good for that. But my God, when you're just really trying to gain strength, whether you're an Olympic weightlifter or just trying to, get your squat and bench press up, stuff like pushing the prowler can sure cut in. I mean, it kills you.
Yeah. People always underestimate. Yeah, that's a new word. They underestimate the destructive power of the prowler. That's a nice little sentence right there. They misunderestimate the destructive power of the prowler when they're prowling the street.
I got to remember that one. but not just the prowler. There's a lot of other stuff you can do that just mangle you. And for you got to show up the next day and squat. You ain't making.
Oh sure, yeah. That's whenever I started doing that stuff, and even when I was early days in CrossFit, I always pointed out that the conditioning should not interfere with the recovery of strength training. And when I do my workshops, I always make the point to say, I can do a lot of things that get sweaty and tired. I mean, I can have sex. I can do a bunch of push-ups. I can do a lot of things that get me tired, but that doesn't mean it's a good conditioning stress or that it should be placed in conjunction with strength training. So,
For what it's worth, a five minute set of kettlebell snatches, after you get done with your workout on Wednesday, doesn't seem to me to interfere that much, and it seems to legitimately get people in better shape and in better condition. That's,
yeah, I was just about to ask what an example of a 5-minute workout would be. Okay, if you're going to cap it at 10 minutes and it's not going to be snatches, what are you going to have someone do for 10 minutes with a kettlebell? Let's say when they're done snatching clean and jerk.
Clean and jerk, the kettlebell.
Okay. So you primarily.
That's about all we do with it, man. That seriously is when it comes to using a kettlebell as conditioning, you will get fancy here and there and have them snatch it or whatever from, you know, on their knees or something like that. But 90% of anything that I would do with a kettlebell for somebody who is using it within a strength program would be three things. Kettlebell swings, not the kind to go over your head, but the kind to go even with your eyes.
Right.
Kettlebell snatches, kettlebell clean and jerks.
Cool.
That's 90%, 95%. Yeah. I don't try to get fancy with it. You get plenty tired in your legs, your hips, your upper back, your arms, plenty winded, breathing plenty hard, sweating plenty hard just by doing the basics. And if you can accomplish it with the basics, there's no need to screw it up by trying to complicate it.
Cool. Okay, we got one more question that just popped up since we've been recording here. And I think this will kind of tie it all together and kind of make it relevant to even the non-weightlifters. Daniel C. is just asking, like, how important is technique to someone that's using the Olympic lifts that's just trying to improve power for another sport? So I guess you can take it technique specific, but you can also talk about using these lifts for development of power just for the sake of athletic ability and stuff.
Well, gosh, I could answer this question for 3 hours. here's the thing. Technique in Olympic weightlifting is about you show up on competition day. You have a basic amount of maximal strength in your body. Let's say we measure maximal strength by squat and deadlift. Let's just say that.
Okay.
And let's say that you have a 500-pound squat and a 500-pound deadlift, okay? Technique is all about getting the most dang weight overhead that you can possibly get overhead given the amount of maximal strength that you have. So we can agree on that, correct?
Right.
Okay. Now, the biggest thing, the biggest way that technique allows you to do that is allows you to use the most powerful muscles in your body, hips and legs, in the most efficient way possible, and to take out the weak links, okay? Weak links being a really terrible position you get yourself in, overuse of smaller muscles like the arms, etc. Those are weak links.
Right.
Great technique takes that out of the question, puts you in position to use your strongest muscles in the strongest way possible. Now, given all that, let us take a guy that can squat 500 and the dang fool is clean at 200 pounds because he's reverse curling it, has no idea how to actually use his legs and hips in the clean.
Right.
How much real work is he doing and how much productive work is he doing in making his legs and hips more powerful? Well, very little.
Right.
Because he's limited by how much he can reverse curl, basically. He's not getting much useful work done for his legs and hips. It's just not there. Now take that same guy and get him some better technique that takes out the weak links and puts him in a better position. Now all of a sudden, he's clean and jerking 400 pounds. Clean and jerking 80% of his back squat, which is very doable for many lifters. Now, how much useful work is his hips and legs doing every time he does a clean? Well, a whole ton.
Sure.
A whole ton. You know? So the better technique you have, the more training effect you have. That's all there is to it. If you're trying to get more powerful, faster, explosive for football, and you're a 500-pound squatter and you're messing around with 200-pound, you know, cleans, you're not doing anything. You might as well do something else, honestly. You have to have good enough technique for the training effect to actually take place in the muscle groups that you want it to take place. If you don't have good enough technique to allow those muscle groups to actually contract maximally and contribute to the lift, then you're treading water there. Nothing's going to happen.
Well, awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast once again, Glenn. And we'll have you on soon again because we got plenty of things to talk about all the time, but that's it for today. You got anything left to say to any of the listeners?
I have ad- Absolutely nothing left to say other than thanks for having me on. I do appreciate it. And of all the people watching, hopefully I will see some of you at the Grand Prix November 5th.
Exactly. November 5th in Charlotte, North Carolina. Muscle Driver Grand Prix inaugural meet. It is, you can sign up for it now. There's no reason that anybody should not sign up for it unless you don't have legs or something like that. So we hope to see a lot of people there. And
if you've got no legs, you can still help us load the bar.
That's true. Alrighty. We'll talk to you next time, Glenn.
Talk to you later, Jeff. Thanks a bunch.